Tonight on The Daily Debrief, actor Jesse Smollett answers to charges that he staged an attack on himself and then lied to police. Plus,
I picked her hand up and I kissed her on the forehand, and she was cold.
The emotional moment when an Iowa farmer said goodbye to his wife. Is his son the killer in this murder on the farm? Also, death, drugs, and dismemberment. Only part of this former judge's body has turned up. Did his son kill him and then chop him up? The nation's top criminal cases are on The Daily Debrief. It's Thursday, March 14th. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to The Debrief. We've got a great panel tonight. Actor Jesse Smollett today pleaded not guilty to 16 charges that he lied to police about an attack prosecutors say he planned against himself. Smollett told police he was attacked by two men who he said were perpetrating a hate crime. Prosecutors say the two men had actually played minor roles on the Fox series Empire, along with Smollett, and that he paid them to attack him. The theory is that he was trying to raise his own profile or even play the victim. Here is some of today's hearing.
So we're going to need a plea. Let me know if you want me to formally read the indictment. You have the option of having me read it, or you can waive readings. Then I'll need a plea of guilty or not guilty.
Your Honor, we waive formal reading of the indictment, and Mr. Smollett enters a plea of not guilty.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Smollett, yes, please be advised that you must be in court each and every court date. Your failure to come to court can result in a warrant for your arrest. If you fail to come to court on your trial date, you can be tried in your absence. And if you are found guilty, you can be sentenced in your absence. So you must be in court each and every court date on time.
One other matter, Your Honor. As part of Mr. Smollett's bail conditions, he's to seek court permission prior to leaving the state. Previously, we had discussed with the people, our offices are located in both California and New York. Having Mr. Smollett be able to travel freely to New York and California to meet with us as needed. I believe the people had no objection. Previously, we did get permission for specific travel, but we would ask Your Honor to approve of him traveling both to California and New York without specific permission from the court each time he needs to do so. Obviously, our schedules are always changing. We don't know exactly when we'll need to meet with him. It would be helpful not to have to run into court every time to seek permission, and we're happy to have him notify his pretrial services officer prior to his travel.
Judge, we have no objection to him traveling to meet his attorneys. It would be helpful if we knew specific dates. However, based upon counsel's representation, the state has no objection.
All right. Well, the motion for the defendant to travel for the sole purpose of meeting with counsel to the states of New York and the state of California will be granted. We're asking that the defendant notify pretrial services at least 48 hours prior to travel, and to notify pretrial services 24 hours on his return.
Smollett also withdrew his previous attorney. Our guests tonight are Judge Ashley Wilcott and Law and Crime Senior Legal Editor Ron Blitzer. He is also a former prosecutor. Good evening to you both. Judge Wilcott, very formulaic here, but the most visual moment, the actual handing of the charges to the defendant himself. It's a formula, but it has to be done.
It absolutely has to be done, and they followed everything as expected and entered a not guilty plea, and they dealt with the fact he can now travel, and that's all there is for now until the next court date.
Ron, I was going to ask you about that. Did you see that as odd or not odd that he's allowed to jump coast to coast here from Chicago for the presumed purpose of meeting with attorneys in different offices?
It's not something that you see in every case, but yeah, given that his attorneys are based in both areas, I think it's perfectly reasonable to ask the court for him to be allowed to travel to see his attorneys, and I'm not surprised that the judge granted it.
And waiving the formal reading of the charges, is that a public relations move, or is it a legal move, or is it both?
That is very common. During an initial hearing, you waive the readings of the rights and charges just as a, you know, just to get it out of the way, just to save time, really.
Judge Wilcott, I'm sure that you see people waive them constantly.
Absolutely, they do. And the interesting thing to me in this case, though, there's 16 counts, one for every lie. We have to start to look at, is every defendant treated the same? So far, he has been.
Certainly. Okay, let's move along here. Day four of testimony in the case of a Florida man accused of murdering his father and dismembering the body before burying some of it on a golf course. James Scandarito Jr. faces the charges but does not face the death penalty. Prosecutors say the defendant took his father's money, had two passports, and lined up a private plane. The defense, however, says Scandarito and his father, who used to be a judge, by the way, were dealing drugs. The defense wants the jury to believe the father died after taking drugs and that James Jr. merely chopped him up so that authorities would not find the drug stash. Police officers testified about an area of the defendant's garage which was suspiciously clean. Here, a crime scene investigator says that area tested positive for presumptive blood, which likely had been cleaned.
Right down the center, you can see some of that luminescence. In this photograph, this is one method of doing it where we'll take the picture in the dark, and then right before the 30 seconds is over, we'll flash the flash of the camera away from the scene just to get a little light into the area so that you can actually see what area that is. This is now taken in the dark. So what you get to see is the brightness of the luminescence a little better than, because once you hit the flash, as in the previous photograph, sometimes it'll wash away some of the color and the brightness. It could be consistent with the presence of blood. What we looked for here is in the little joints between the stick-on tiles. I believe we'll be coming up to the picture where it's very prominent. And what we'll do is we'll peel up the tiles on the ends, rip them up, and attempt to swab that area there in hopes that whatever cleaning on the surface didn't get as deep as the cracks in between the tile.
So it indicated to you a presumptive positive for blood?
Correct.
Later, witnesses testified that it was indeed human blood, not only on the floor, but also on both a nearby box and a nearby handcart. So, is the garage where the defendant caught up his father's body? That seems to be the state's theory. The police also watched the defendant throw some strange items into a dumpster. Here is what investigators found there.
Once I got close to it, I smelt a distinct odor of decomposition and had an idea that there might be something of interest in that dumpster. Yes, when I started walking towards it, yes, I could smell it.
Okay. So what do you do then?
We opened the dumpster, and I was happy to see that it was pretty much empty of garbage, and I saw a towel covering some items on the floor of the dumpster.
What do you do with those items?
We eventually take them out of the dumpster and place them on the front of the ground to document them. I took some pictures in the dumpster showing the way they were, and they were actually covered with a beach towel or a big bath towel. Okay, that shows the bag which contained clothing, sneakers, and the other is the gas can, which had some type of a partially burnt sock or rag in the handle of the gas can. Discovered one of two suitcases. There was actually some weight to this suitcase. It was crawling with maggots and smelled heavily of decomposition. And once I felt the weight of it, I wasn't sure what was inside. Upon opening it, I discovered a second suitcase.
The inside of the suitcases tested positive for human blood. Next, testimony about the discovery of the victim's body on a golf course under a fresh patch of sand.
We had two plastic bags that were both wrapped in duct tape.
And are the bags ever opened in front of you?
Yes, they are. One was partially torn open. One was still pretty well sealed.
When you say wrapped in duct tape, can you describe how the bag is actually wrapped?
It was a large black plastic bag. It was tied, and then the duct tape was around it in different directions.
Could you see how the bag was tied?
I'd have to see a photo. I don't recall.
Okay. And then you said one was wrapped in the duct tape, one was partially opened.
One was torn. I don't say it was partially open. It was torn. The bag was torn.
Was that bag also attempted to be secured with duct tape?
Yes, it was.
Are the bags opened in your presence?
Yes, they were.
And can you tell the members of the jury what you saw when the bags were opened?
The first bag we opened, it contained a torso of what appeared to be a white male. The torso, the arms were severed. There was no arms on the torso. And the torso was decapitated. There was no head on the torso. And it was cut right around the navel area, a full cut across.
Was the second bag that was still secured open as well?
Yes, it was.
And what did you observe was contained inside that bag?
Second bag was the lower torso. Again, that was severed right above or below the navel.
Again, our former prosecutor Ron Blitzer and Judge Ashley Wilcott. So, Ron, let me ask you this. Is this guy a drug dealer trying to protect his stash, or is he a killer who left the body of his father in those bags without the head attached?
Well, that is the question. I'm inclined to lean towards the latter. I think that, you know, he is guilty here, and he's trying to cover that up and come up with a different story.
Evidence of premeditation here. We've got the passports, we've got the flight, we've got the money moving hands. Like, it sounds sort of like what we would see in a movie involving a drug dealer, but it also could be premeditation.
Well, I think, too, think about the fact to dismember a body, that takes a lot of deliberate action, and I think that can tie into the premeditation, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't just something where it's one cut, two cuts, like you're putting together dinner. I mean, this is a lot of, connective tissue. This is not an easy task.
Absolutely, and I don't think that you just decide, what am I going to do to get rid of a body? I'm going to cut it apart. I don't believe that story, that version. I think it takes a lot more forethought to do that.
Ron Blitzer, what other evidence do you think prosecutors could really stand to have here to shore up this case?
I think you're going to have to really get into, you know, exactly what happened during that time, trying, press the story about, you know, the types of drugs and what really was going on at the time and what, you know, was going through his head.
Being key here, the debit card was used this day. It was used that day. The flight was lined up this day. That's how you prove the premeditation is with the timeline, not necessarily through the fact that all of these things were exactly happening. So we'll be back in with the panel in just a couple of minutes at the end of the broadcast. Now, to Brian Ross in our newsroom for a look at what's ahead tonight on Brian Ross Investigates. Brian, what's in store?
Well, Aaron, tonight a close look at the college cheating scandal, what the FBI called Operation Varsity Blues. We'll have revealing details about the whole college application process, how it really works behind the scenes. Is what's legal just as distasteful as what's illegal? Also, what about the students who got into college because their parents paid bribes? Should they now be kicked out? Coming up right behind you, Aaron, here on Law and Crime.
A lot to talk about with this case. I look forward to listening to it. Of course, a new lawsuit filed today. Brian, I know you've got it all covered.
Exactly.
Still ahead tonight, murder on the farm. The husband of the victim, the father of the defendant, taking the stand for the prosecution as authorities try to prove that an Iowa farmer killed for money. We'll take you back inside the courtroom for that emotional testimony in just a moment. Welcome back to The Debrief, ladies and gentlemen. Day five of testimony in the case of an Iowa man accused of murdering his mother because he needed money to prop up his failing farm. Prosecutors say the timeline fits for Jason Carter to have killed his mother, Shirley, and then staged the scene to look like a botched robbery. The defense claimed that friends and family would testify that Carter loved his mother and that the family got along well. That claim backfired today. Tearful testimony today came from Bill Carter, father to the defendant, husband to the victim. Here, he talks about his final moments with his wife after he saw her body.
Jason was on the deck talking on the phone. I didn't even stop. I just went running in the house.
What did you see?
I found Shirley on the floor. And she was just looked like she was sleeping. Her eyes were closed. Her hands were crossed. And her legs were crossed.
What did you do?
Jason came in. And I said, Jason, look how she's laying. You don't die that way. And then he said, Dad, go downstairs, see if a gun went off.
And did you?
I had a picture. The first thing I did was check her carotid artery. And she was dead. And then I picked her hand up and I kissed her on the forehead. And she was cold. Then he came in and said, Dad, go downstairs. And I started down the stairway and I said, I never had any guns loaded. I never had any guns loaded. And I went back up and I picked her hand up and I held her. There was a small pool of blood along her left side. It wasn't drying. It was liquid.
How do you know that, Bill?
I could tell. I stayed out of it while I held her head.
Bill, did Jason say anything else to you at this time?
He started pointing out bullet holes. He pointed out one in the refrigerator and one in the floor.
How did he point them out?
He just said, Dad, look at that bullet hole in the refrigerator, and then there was a bad gouge in the floor. And he said, he was standing in the doorway between the kitchen and the office, and he said, some son of a bitch has robbed you and they've killed Mom.
Bill Carter also testified about his will. This is the key to the state's theory of the case. Farming involves a lot of money.
Was Jason Carter in 2015 aware what was in your will?
Yes.
How was he aware what was in your will?
When Shirley and I changed the will, we showed Jason and Shelley what we had done. We showed them the will.
And when you say Shelley, who is Shelley?
Shelley is Jason's wife.
Did Jason play any role in the administration of your will?
He was appointed the executor.
Bill, if both you and Shirley had died on June 19, 2015, what would have Jason Carter inherited?
He would have gotten the farm, which was worth $3.5 to $4 million, and another $800,000, at least, in cash assets.
2015. Did you start to have concerns that Jason was going to struggle to pay off his farming debts?
Yes, I did. Commodity markets had dropped. And our expenses stayed the same. Seed, corn, fertilizer, chemicals stayed the same. So it was bound to happen to all farmers. I mean, it was, especially if you were renting a lot of ground.
What did you think he was going to have to, how much was he going to come up short?
I assume somewhere between $100,000 and $150,000.
Had you, in years past, bailed him out before?
Once.
Now, once again, to Ron Blitzer and Judge Ashley Wilcott on this one. I've struggled to think of a more sad piece of testimony than what we just witnessed. Judge Wilcott.
No, I completely agree. He's so credible. You're so empathetic. It's a horrible situation. He's distraught. He's devastated. That's going to weigh greatly on the jury and their decision?
Oh, certainly. I mean, credibility, sadness. He lost his wife, and now his son is sitting in the defendant's chair. The theory, though, here is an important one, Ron, and he got through the details of his will. But the key is that both Shirley and Bill, that witness, would have needed to die for this defendant to take anything under the will. So is the prosecution even pressing a sound theory that this defendant would have killed for money? Because he, if this is true, only killed one and not the other.
Yeah, personally, I don't like that theory of the case. If you're trying to say that he had all these debts and he did this over money so he could inherit something, because like you said, like we just heard in this testimony, they both would have had to die in order for him to get anything. With only one of his parents dead and his father still alive, you know, he doesn't benefit at all from this.
Not only that, but he'd have to get away with it too, because if you're involved in perpetrating someone's death, the law is that you can't take under their will, or you can't take if it moves through probate court. So the theory is a little bit strange, but let's talk about this now as well. We had tough cross-examination of the father this afternoon. Judge Wilcott, you were here listening to a lot of that. What can you tell us?
So on the cross-examination, the thing that I noticed is they were trying to discredit him with the timeline with some things he'd said in a prior inconsistent statement. But the other piece of that in his cross-examination, you know, he didn't act as if the family had this great loving relationship with Jason that the defense, as I recall, had said in opening they expected to show. Instead, he had some negative things to say about his son.
Yeah, Ron, as a defense attorney, you have to have credibility with a jury because the jury is going to be skeptical. I mean, it should be the other way around, but oftentimes juries are more skeptical of the defense than of the prosecution, despite the burden of proof. Does the defense have a shred of credibility left saying this family was great, they all got along fine, and then having the father get up there and lightly bash the defendant, his son?
Yeah, it's tough when you are a defense attorney, especially, you know, in a case like this when you're questioning a sympathetic witness such as the father here. So you really have to, you know, tiptoe around certain issues.
Is it possible that the defendant told the defense attorneys, yeah, everything was fine in the family, and that the defense got blindsided?
Absolutely, 100%, because all they know is, other than the evidence they expect to be presented, is what their client has told them.
You know, the numbers are another interesting point here. He needed 150 grand. The farm was worth millions. Mm-hmm. That could stick with jurors, too. A fascinating case. We're going to continue to cover it. Great to have you both here. Judge Ashley Wilcott, former prosecutor Ron Blitzer of LawAndCrime.com.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you.
We'll see you both next time. And we'll see you again tomorrow. We appreciate you watching the Daily Debrief tonight. I, of course, will be back tomorrow at 5 o'clock Eastern right here on the Law and Crime Network with this nightly recap of the best moments of testimony in cases nationwide. Our live trial coverage begins tomorrow at 9 o'clock in the morning. Have a good night.